Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Well, it's Tuesday afternoon, which means it's real people. And you are in for another treat. In fact, you're in for a wonderful treat. In fact, I'm going to hold the suspense even as I talk. You're going to be wondering, who's he got this week? And you've just been listening to the great and wonderful Sashmo. What a wonderful world. Which means it's got to be real people and it's got to be in the psychotherapist chair. Which means you're going to have a treat of an interview. You're going to have the amazing gift of my incredible reflections. And you're going to have some wonderful music. So I hope you're going to settle down and enjoy this program. And has the suspense got you yet? Are you sitting on the edge of your seat? Are you just really wondering, oh my goodness, who's Jerry got this week? Well, it is a real treat. I'm going to find this interview so hard because I love this woman from the bottom of my heart. It is Alia Bland, she of VFF and RCR. I could go on for half an hour talking about this woman's great courage and her incredible abilities to pull Kiwis together, to join us together. And I'm going to shut up because you'll be wanting to know all about her. So, Alia, bless you and thank you for coming on this little show. And it's such a pleasure to have this time with you and to find out and share with the listeners a little bit more about you and your life. Welcome into the psychotherapist chair, Alia.
Oh, thanks, Jerry. That was a lovely intro. I feel very loved. Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah. It's far easier for me to work or see people I don't really like than people I really like a lot. So I hope it means I don't do a completely rubbish job today, but I'm really thrilled to have you sitting in the chair. And I'm just wondering, in a way, my guess is, Alia, that it's not something you actually like to do too much, is to put yourself in the public view. Amazingly, for what you've done and what you continue to do, I think, am I right in saying it actually isn't all that comfortable for you to be in the limelight like this?
I would say that up until the age of 40, I did everything within my power to keep out of the the public limelight and any opportunity that it had any kind of public speaking element to it. I would run a mile, absolute mile. I was a kid that would fake sicknesses on school speeches day. You know, when I was teaching, I could easily speak in front of hundreds of children, but I would hate to speak in front of the staff at the staff room. You know, like it wasn't me. I didn't have that kind of confidence. But something happened after I turned 40, and I don't know that it was a conscious decision, but I did just decide to start saying yes to things instead of saying no. And at the time, I was a crochet pattern designer. One of those crafty dangers to society. And a woman asked me whether or not I would take some workshops. And I thought, you know, everything in me was screaming, no, run. But I thought, yeah, I'll just say yes and I'll challenge myself to get over it. So I think that was the turning point at which I started being more courageous in speaking in front of other people. But when this came around, it was a no-brainer. Like, I just didn't. When you're passionate about something, it becomes easy, in my experience anyway. And I overcame those kind of fears of standing in front of lots and lots of people or presenting in front of, you know, 12,000 people on a Zoom call. It's it's quite surreal, really.
That in itself is such an interesting contradiction, isn't it? And had you had your children by then?
Oh, yeah. I had my first child was, I think I was 27 when I had my first baby.
So, and how many children have you got?
I've got three sons. Three sons. And, you know, I was, well, I am now, some sort of failed trad wife, much to Kate Hannah and Paula Penfold's disgust. You know, we made the decision when we had our babies to live life simply and to have me at home, being the mum at home and cooking and looking after them and just enjoying their childhood and being there as a mother, just like a lot of us had for our childhood.
Yes. And so, you know, apart from sitting quietly in the corner, doing your crochet, you also decided you'd set up and run a national organization and a radio station just in your spare time, right?
Yeah. Well, at that time, my kids were getting a bit older. So when the lockdowns happened and everyone else was baking sourdough bread, I had my nose in all the science, the research that was coming out, the statistics, what was happening around the world. And I couldn't not be involved. I was just outraged about what I was seeing. And I could see totally what was coming down the line. You know, despite the fact of the government officials telling us otherwise, I knew what was coming. And there were markers along the way that were bedding that in, making sure that it was going to happen. Yeah, so it was at that point that my children stepped up and learned how to cook some more and clean some more and look after themselves some more. And I lost my trad wife badge.
I am dying to get started, but this is so interesting. And we are getting started, of course we are. But I wonder about when you talk about this. I mean, for example, how old are your kids now? Just out of interest, I'd love to know what age your kids are.
My youngest is 14, and then I have a 17-year-old who is in his last year of school and a 19-year-old who's finished. Yeah, all at home.
And so many listeners and so many of us in these times have had to struggle with family relationships where there has been, let us put it mildly, a difference of opinion. How has it been in your family during all this time of vaccine mandates, lockdowns, and the deceptions of a government that seems hell-bent, doesn't matter who's in parliament, I think, on every level, there's still so much to fight for. But how has it been, and how was it in your family? Because I'm sure the listeners will be interested in how that was, because these are stories that need to be told, right, all across New Zealand about what actually happened at home in our everyday lives. And would you be willing to share a little bit about how that was for you?
Yeah, well, I'm lucky in that in my immediate family, so my husband and my children, we were all on the same page. I guess my kids didn't have much of a choice, but they do, but they saw the madness alongside us. It was tricky, though, because Mum was speaking out and being called a domestic terrorist by the media and the government and all of that sort of thing. So, and we live in a small town. So I didn't make a whole lot of noise locally to protect them, really, because they were already facing a lot of backlash for the decisions that was, you know, for not wearing the masks or not taking the poison. You know, I just wanted to protect them that little bit more because of that. But I don't know how people do it when they have a loved one that they live so closely with who is completely on the other pager. I don't think that would have lasted around here if that was the situation. But I was also very lucky that almost all of our families on both sides were completely on board, which is pretty rare. My husband is one of seven. And that, you know, his almost entire family that we're in contact with, we're on the same page, and same with all of their children too. So we were very, very lucky in that we didn't have those additional sort of stresses happening within our immediate sort of families.
And like you, I am in awe and actually sometimes in quite a lot of pain when I hear the stories of what's happened within relationships, within parent-child relationships, within broader family relationships, and of course in communities. And because of my work, I know that trauma needs a lot of work to overcome. And I feel like we've stored up for ourselves a lot of work for the next 10, 20, 30 years. I don't know if you have a view on that, Alia.
I think oh, bless those people who managed to get through it. It's such a big thing in my life, what is happening around the world. I can't begin to imagine living closely with another person that you love who you just can't see eye to eye on it. It's such a fundamental thing about your belief about the world that it would, to me, it would feel really superficial to, I mean, I guess, you know, you try and find the things that you do agree on for sure. But yeah, I can see that it will create, whether people stay together or separate, that there will be a level of trauma there that is going to take a lot of work to move through for sure.
Yes, and I think it is an issue that is very hard to bury, and it drives a wedge. Like, my fundamental position on relationships is certainly the closest ones, you know, like with my wife. And if there's a secret held, there's a wedge being driven, and it festers and it grows. And this is the great concern. I've got several concerns about times and feel like I'm prepping myself more and more for a storm, really. I'm just taking what time I can to make sure my health is as good as it can be, because I believe there's, you know, for people like me and counselors and social workers and people that work in the community and family members, I think there's going to be so much work to do around healing. We're all going to have to become, like we've had to become scientists, and we've had to understand viruses or their, you know, their shapes, or their questioning their existence scientifically, and, you know, legal, finance. We've all had to become aware citizens, right, over the last 3 or 4 years. And I think we're all going to have to become so aware of the psychological nature of our well-being, our resilience, and how we build bridges across what seem like uncrossable chasms now between so many people.
Yes, and holding compassion too for those people who are only just starting to wake up to the reality of what's happening. I mean, it's easy for people to get into camps and decide that they're just going to shut out a whole section of society, but it's not helpful. And we keep banging on that the only way that we get out of this is sheer numbers of people who are prepared to stand up and push back. The next time, whatever the madness, whatever form it comes in, we all stand together and say, no, we're not going to do this. And so, you know, our little community, which is not that little, it's quite large, of the people that did that the first time around, does need to grow in order to be stronger next time.
Well, I suspect I could spend days talking with you about the situation, but this program is actually about this very subject. It's actually about how we understand what makes us human, how we understand how we become who we are, and how we change, and how we manage trauma and stress. So I'd like to dive in to the life of Alia Bland, if you're okay with that.
Yes, it's rather nerve-wracking.
Well, I haven't got the interrogation desk ready yet, and I haven't got the spotlights, and let's start off with, let's go right back to the beginning. When were you born?
When?
Yes.
When? I was a 70s baby, born to a couple of young hippies, they were at the time. My mother had me when she was 20. And born in Auckland, lived out at Piha as a small child, and then eventually moved over to Waiheke Island, which is where I spent most of my childhood, which was idyllic.
Well, now, right there, our lives collide, not in time, but in geography, because I left New Zealand when I was 4 years old. But in the 2 years prior to leaving, I lived on Waiheke Island.
Ah.
On Rat- I lived on Rata Street.
Yes.
And my earliest memories, actually, I do have some vivid memories of every other day. My mother, she was quite an organized person. And every other day, we would walk down with my baby brother in a pram and my older brother trying to kick me or pinch me or do something to me. And we used to walk down to the beach every other day. And I have these embedded memories of the long walk, of course, it was only about 100 yards. It really wasn't that far at all. But the long walk from Rata Street down to the beach. And sometimes I think we went to the beach on the other side. And so some of my most vivid memories, in fact, my most vivid memory is from being swum around in the sea on my father's back, holding on to his neck and being swum around by him. I can viscerally remember that. So Waiheke Island is very, very precious to me. We actually owned a batch. I think it was about a $10 batch in the day. And my mother sold it when we came to England for $500. Can you believe that?
Oh, wow.
I say, Mum, you should have just kept hold of it. We'd be millionaires now.
Yeah, it's really changed a lot since those days. I mean, back when I was there, it was a lot of hippies and alternative types of people. It was very free. Now it is, the demographics changed completely, but it was a very special place. It was a sort of place that, you know, the cliche, you would get on your bike in the morning and you would take off for the day with a couple of dollars in your pocket for the local dairy for some cheesels and something, you know, to keep you going, and you would return back at dark. No one knew where you were, but the community was small enough that, you know, people would sort of see you, that if anything happened, you'd be able to track them down. It was really special, and I guess that's to a degree what we're fighting for our kids, is to have that, you know, a similar level of freedom within today's context that hasn't been taken away from them by the powers that be.
It's a great theme that keeps recurring on these shows, and particularly on the monthly show that I do, the Psychobabble panel. We have a child psychologist there called Ros Neelan Cook from Sydney, and she is such a great speaker about the need for children's health, the need really for us to roll back the use of screens, the use of phones, to literally fight back for those childhoods, those precious golden childhoods of carefree boredom. You know, don't forget boredom for children. It's so important for children to be bored. No one seems to have time to be bored, or they're always going on to some distracting screen. So it's like their minds are being, I don't know, trapped in the screen. There is so much to do around this, and the freedom to roam and be safe and community. Mm. Yes. Oh, I'm so with you on that. What were your favorite childhood memories? I mean, the ones that you feel, you know, contributed most to your growing and your view on life, really?
Well, I think we had quite, you know, we were quite a simple family, but we lived in paradise. And so, you know, our friends and I, we would just wander around and we'd go to the beaches and we would rock hop, you know, for miles around the rocks of the, you know, the coastline of Waiheke Island, over, you know, bits where you'd have to dive in and through the caves. And, you know, that sort of thing is something that sticks with me, that memory of childhood, that freedom to just roam and explore and take risks. But you didn't really know you were sort of taking risks. Now, I mean, gosh, people just would never let their kids do that, I don't think, for hours like that at the age that we used to do it. Yeah, so I think it was just that freedom that my friends and I had to just explore where we lived. And, you know, Waiheke was quite big to a child. You could get around. And we used to, you know, hitchhike a lot as well as we got older into our teens, which is another thing that probably doesn't happen so much now for safety concerns.
Wow. They say that every psychotherapist has to be bonkers to become a good psychotherapist, or has to have bonkers parents, one or the other. I think I probably have both of those qualifications, but I used to say that if you want to prove your parents being certifiably insane, then you'd have to say leave paradise in Waiheke Island at the very beginning of the 1960s. Just leave paradise and go to you know, smoggy, miserable, cloudy England. I mean, you it's like voluntarily choosing hell over heaven. It's just, you'd have to be certifiable, wouldn't you?
That's really unfortunate. I'm sorry that happened, Jerry. We were kind of the opposite. We were living in West Auckland at the time before we shifted to Waiheke. And my father worked for the post office, which is like the old, you know, Telecom, which is now Spark, I suppose. And a job came up over on Waiheke. No one had ever been there before. And they just decided to sort of take it sight unseen because it came with a house and, you know, it got us out of a terrible kind of living situation where we had pretty rowdy neighbours, and it was quite violent, and not asked them. And and so we moved over there, and it was all fresh. And, you know, we had to start new as kids. I think I was 10 at the time that we moved, and I'm the oldest of three. That would have been in the mid-80s. Yeah, but it was an amazing change.
That sounds quite a contrast.
Mm.
What area of Auckland were you in before you moved to Waiheke?
It was a place in West Auckland called Sunnyvale, which at the time, you know, for the most part, I did enjoy living there. I probably didn't have the same perspective as my parents did on the neighbours. It was before all of the infill housing, so there were paddocks behind our house that I would just go and, you know, trickle over the stream and dig around and place it just by myself, and roam around and go and see the scary racehorses over the back. And there was a bit of forest, and there was somebody living in the forest that was, I'm sure that's not a made up memory. And so, you know, I, even though it wasn't the greatest, I still have really fond memories of that time.
Yeah. So one of the lovely things about doing this program in a place as amazing as New Zealand is that families have such interesting backstories. You know, how did your parents get to be there? How did their parents? What's the story going back of your families? Where did they originate from? What do you know about your backstory of your families?
Well, I'm probably like a lot of people in New Zealand, a real mix, a bit of a mongrel of all sorts. I don't know a whole lot that goes back more than just a couple of sort of generations, but one of my grandmothers, my father's mother, she was a mix of Croatian and Māori, and she grew up on the gum fields and up in Northland, very poor. And, you know, we heard the stories because it was, she would have been growing up in the time of the Great Depression, of, you know, getting an orange for Christmas and being elated by that. One of many children, and had a tough time with a father that was not terribly nice. And but, you know, she had a good life too, and she went on to be a great pattern maker. So she was a tailor, I suppose. And she passed that love on to me. And it was my mother as well, was a dressmaker and very creative in that space. And so I have a lot of really fond memories of going over to my grandmother's and living in her sewing room for days on end, making different items of clothing and taking measurements and cutting her own patterns. And even as a little kid, my mum, you know, I grew up with industrial sewing machines and things like that, and overlockers and what have you. And so I would create and cut my own patterns. It sort of must have only been 5 or 6. And sew them up on the industrial sewing machine, which is, if you've ever experienced one of those things, they go like a racehorse, and they, you know, they'll take your finger if you're not careful. So, you know, that was a really special thing with my grandmother there. Unfortunately, she grew up at a time where her Māori heritage was not something that her family was proud of. And I understand that on my great-grandmother's deathbed, my grandmother promised her that she wouldn't pursue anything to do with that side of her history. And so as a family, we're left guessing as to where we've come from along that line. We suspect it's a certain tribe in Northland, but we don't really know. And And so there's a lot of sort of question marks about that side of our history. And then I think on the other side is just a general sort of mix of European, I guess probably English, Irish, Scottish, but all born here for a few generations. So it's no kind of recent arrivals.
Mm.
Kiwi.
Absolutely. The amazing mix of heritage, which actually everyone has, because, you know, we very, very many people go back with mixed heritage. The interesting bit there is, I mean, what an important piece of New Zealand history right there with your grandmother promising her mother that she would speak nothing of her Maori heritage. You know, that right there it's right there, and you don't know and your kids don't know that particular route. But nor probably do you know the European roots that far back, you know.
That's true.
What was going on as well. But right here in New Zealand at this time, it's a really important part of our coming to terms with who we are here. I struggle to know who I am at the best of times anywhere, but knowing who I am in terms of myself as a Kiwi born, but then kidnapped to this dull grey place up in the north. The point is, to have no links at all and to come back here 58 years later poses all sorts of problems of belonging. And I think it's not just about Māori, but it's about all our heritages, all our roots. The beautiful thing about many Māori families and roots is that some have been able to preserve that history in a way that most Westerners haven't. In that way, you're not being able to go more than a couple of generations back. It's very Western, right? It's very like fragmented, mobile families. But the bit that's really also equally interesting is that little bit of Croatian. That's really interesting. What did you know about that Croatian background?
Not a lot, really, because not much was spoken about my great-grandfather, because he wasn't overly liked. So he was Croatian, and then my great-grandmother was, I think, half and half. So they had it on both sides on that line. But it's somewhere that I, you know, have seen as an adult that it's somewhere I'd love to go at one day to go and visit, for sure. No, I haven't. And it's something that I guess, you know, when you're younger, it's not something that really takes your interest. Well, it didn't with me anyway, where my roots came from or anything. I was just getting on with life. It's only when you get older that you start to think about these sorts of things and, gee, where did people come from? And I have spent a bit of time on those genealogy sites tracking back things, but I haven't really found anything that's kind of, you know, much of a revelation. Mm.
Yes, and I share this this break of knowledge past my grandparents, actually. And it's like a big mysterious hole, really, of what the stories of our families are. And I've said many times on the show, in my work as a therapist, I actually find I probably rely more on my history training. As at university, I did history, and I was a history teacher first for a few years. And to me, so much is in our history that we don't even realize. And it's just, there's something deeply reassuring about knowing where we come from. And that's why I admire and feel immensely jealous of those Māori families that do know their roots, as they go right back to the waka that they came over in. It's just beautiful. And it's a precious reminder of what has been taken from civilization over the last couple of hundred years with industrialization and almost the atomization of communities. It's a really, for that, I love the Māori culture. I feel in awe of those stories. All of that you described was on your father's side, wasn't it? What do you know about your mother's side? You said she was a dressmaker. Is that right?
Well, my mother, yeah, she's an artist. So she does a whole lot of different things. So we did sort of a whole lot of fabric art, and oh gosh, we could go on for ages about all the different types of kind of creative things that mum did as we were growing up. She always had a sideline business as well as, you know, being an at-home mum. So it's, I guess I followed in those footsteps. Yeah, but my mother's side, you know, to tell you the truth, I'm not really sure. I don't really know where her father's roots came from. He He was around when I was little, but he remarried and had a second family and jumped over the ditch and lived the rest of his life in Australia. He was a musician, a jazz musician, actually. We never really saw much of him ever again. And so it wasn't, you know, it just wasn't a relationship that I know a lot about him or his past. I mean, I suspect that he too, just European descent. My grandmother on my mother's side, oh, she was a firecracker. She was this tiny little woman who had an extremely sharp tongue, and she could whip you to pieces, you know, into a puddle of tears in no time. I suspect her background is probably Irish and, maybe Scottish. I'm not sure. I'd have to ask my mother. I'm sure I have been told these things before, but I tend to forget them if they don't have any kind of bearing for me. But there's a story about my nana. She had really high expectations of us as kids. Like my other grandparents, my father's parents, were your classic kind of cuddly, loving grandparents that we spent a lot of time with. You know, most weekends we would be there. Nana always had the food, you know, comfort food going, and you were just generally looked after and dressed, and you know, all your needs were taken care of. My other grandmother, bless her heart, she's passed away now. She was the opposite. She had high expectations of us three kids. We were her only grandchildren, my mother's children, and she was not shy in coming forward with any criticisms that she had of what you were doing, what you looked like, how you were dressing, all of those sorts of things, and most of the family were utterly terrified of her just because she could be incredibly cruel. But at the same time, she was also very generous, and you knew that she loved you, but just not in the same way as the other set of grandparents. You know, you just, as a child, it wasn't a judgment thing. You just knew that there were these two different types of grandparents that you had. Anyway, I think when I don't recall ever having made a conscious decision about this, but in my early 20s, I just decided that I wasn't going to take it anymore, her BS behavior, and I wasn't going to be a cowering wimp. And I'd never said anything, but I just made a determination that that was not going to happen anymore. I was going to stand up to her if that's what it took. And it never took that. Just the energy of the change and that way of being around her, the strength. And I don't know whether that was her pushing for that. Maybe it was, you know, to find your strength. And she, after that, it just turned. For me only, probably. So she still was like that to everyone else. But to me, she didn't dare do the things that she used to do. And she was, she just became a much more loving, generous woman to me and then my children as well. So that's an interesting story. I mean, to the point where when she was on her deathbed, she had Parkinson's and she declined quite badly over the last sort of 3 or 4 years of her life. And but in a way that she became very childlike and her personality completely changed. But even then, members of my family wouldn't go and see her because they're still too terrified of the way that she was. So right to her deathbed, she sort of carried the consequence of her harshness.
Wow, what a touching story, actually, of almost different styles of grandparenting and by definition, parenting. I often think that we should start life at the age of 90 and work our ways backwards. If we could just start with the wisdom that we get over time, you know. But it's really interesting because you describe there something so fascinating, which is an internal shift in you, not even requiring the confrontation. It's as if she smelt it, you know, it's as if she got the energy of that decisiveness in you. And yeah, maybe, I don't know, maybe all that toughness and that criticism kind of built you stronger than just the cuddly stuff would have done.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, when you look at it that way, whether that's what I said, I don't know whether she intended it to be that way or not, but it was like a lesson, right? Like she was forcing you to put, you know, to stand your ground and to stand up for yourself, whether or not she meant to do that or it was just a character flaw of hers, who knows. But it had the right result. And I guess, I mean, you know, to be fair, I was a fairly, I've always been a fairly toughy sort of a person and determined, and you know, I guess you just had to push it in that particular relationship.
What's your most vivid sticking up for yourself memory as a child? Do you have a thing that you did that you really, really stood up for yourself? And I don't know, just wondering.
Oh, gosh. I probably caused a bit more trouble than necessarily standing up for myself. One memory that... that I remember, I don't know if it was so much standing up for myself, but we as a group, I think we were on our fourth form, so goodness knows what that is now, year 10 or something, camp. So from Waiheke, we had come over to the Waitakere's in Auckland to do this massive, massive hike through the Waitakes over to Piha. And of course, you know, none of us had done anything like that, little softies. And, you know, carrying these huge packs with far too much canned food in it that was really heavy and, you know, ill-fitting footwear and all of that sort of jazz. And so when we actually got one way, so we had to come over, but then we had to go back again as a second part of the trip. And I remember just digging my heels in once we got here and said, no, I'm not going back. And I managed to call this grandmother, actually, Sticky Beak grandmother, to come and pick us, me and my friends, up. And we got ourselves home and just said to the teachers, no, we're stuffed. We're not doing this. It's too much. We're all shattered. And we hadn't had any sort of preparation for it. I mean, stupidly now you look back at it and think, God, you should have stuck in and pushed yourself harder. But that was probably an example of throwing your weight around at a young age.
And which grandmother was it that came and picked you up? Which of the two grandmothers?
The little one. The little. The little
mother's. One. Your mother's mother.
Yeah. Oh dear.
So I am so fascinated by these. Sometimes also the hidden roots and what that might mean. Sometimes I think the absence of a story is more of a story than the story itself. That the fact that we don't have stories going back beyond your maternal grandmother, you know, the fact that there's a sort of a silence there. And in my field, silences are often quite ominous. Silences often contain trauma and they often contain pain. I'm thinking about what you said. I mean, first of all, you did have defiance by the age of 13 or 14, clearly.
I probably had it earlier than that, my mother would tell you.
Yeah. So you had that. But I'm also interested in this almost instinctive parenting style of your mother's mother, your maternal grandmother, the firecracker. Almost like when you stood strong, she could relax. It was as if her job was done. You know, that somehow, while the others were not demonstrating it to her in the way, there was something about that crossing of the Rubicon, you know, that movement to, you know, at the age of 20, I'm not going to take this anymore. It's as if when she saw that, she could relax with you. And that makes me wonder whether there was this generational survival strategy that you just had to be tough to get through, right? So, and it's a passing down of a lesson of toughness. And it makes me wonder what happened to her, what happened to her parents, and going on back that was learned. What do you think about that theory I've just proposed?
Yeah, it could well be. I mean, my mother might say otherwise. My poor mother has, you know, that there's a lot of scars there from the way that she was treated right from a child, actually, by her mother.
Yes.
And maybe she might just say she was a piece of work. But I don't know. I mean, I do recall I had a grumpy great-grandfather, but see, this is the thing, I guess, that they all died when I was too young to really know them. And so maybe that's just a consequence of the more modern life, that people had children older in their lives. And as a result, you didn't get to know your grandparents or great-grandparents. Yeah, I mean, it could well have been that. I really don't know, Jerry, and it's a shame because you can never ask, and you don't realise that when you're young, you know, that you've sort of wasted opportunities to talk about these things until it's too late.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the greatest opportunities that an education system has is even when families don't. I mean, it's sometimes quite divisive. When I was a history teacher, I used to start off with my 11-year-olds, and I used to say, find the oldest piece of tat in your house and bring it in, you know. So they, and it was a complete experiment. I'd never been taught to do that. And it was a complete experiment. Oh my goodness. What turned up was some of the most amazing things. We had wartime gas masks from the First World War.
Wow. Turn up.
You know, we had ancient pottery that someone had collected. We had, they used to bring in, the oldest piece was of course fossils. They used to bring in fossils and stuff like that. And that was it for the year. I mean, we took each of those pieces and we found the history of them and we looked up and we found out. And the class went on an adventure with me. But of course, there were some children who had nothing.
Yeah.
I was teaching in the early 1980s. The oldest thing in some houses was a cushion that had been brought when they were five in the house.
Yeah.
And that was hard, you know, because you were confronting the fact that some families have their roots and some don't. And I feel for both families equally. So I think they just avoid the problem now, which is a shame because I think these problems do define us. Anyway, history, family, wonderful. What a beautiful picture. And then it sounds like you made a big decision with your husband to be, you know, a stay-at-home mum, obviously because you didn't have the intelligence or the ability to do anything else. So you got to stay at home because you were just some dumb little mouse who sat in a corner crocheting. Clearly that's the picture, right?
Yeah, well, maybe not. You know, before that I was a primary teacher and I had been teaching at a school. And so when I left there, it was quite a culture shock to go from that to having no community. You know, you don't realize how that is until you do it. So it is quite lonely the way that we organize ourselves, especially in the cities. It's less so once we moved out to the coast. You know, you very quickly get to know the people out there and form a community. It's completely different. We said that we'd met more people in the first 5 months of being out here than we had in 10 years in the city. Nobody wants to know you. And so you do things on your own in that sort of situation. But yeah, I mean, we didn't want to outsource our parenting to, I couldn't think of anything worse for me, for us. Like, I'm not judging other people for doing that, but just in our situation, daycare and things was just not on the cards at all. Like, you know, I was you're a typical kind of crunchy mother that wanted to have home births and just nourish my children at home, and we did. You know, it was a struggle at times because we'd only just started my husband's business, and so, you know, that takes a little while to build up, and so we lived on the smell of an oily rag for a long time. But I don't mind doing that. You know, it makes you creative and it makes you decide what your priorities are, what's important in life, what you need, what you don't need, what you can make, what you can get creative and make yourself, or, you know, get on the cheap from different places. So I think it was the right choice for us anyway. And when we were, my kids, my last one was little, we were going to change the way that we lived again. And we'd been living in a reasonably big, nice house out at Karikari Beach, which is the most beautiful beach for those people who haven't been there. It is the scene of the movie The Piano. And it's rugged and raw. And when you stand on the beach and you look back in certain directions, you can't see any sign of human beings. And it's sort of like you're looking back and, you know, there could be dinosaurs wandering around, you know, like it's that sort of feeling. It's rugged and raw. And so we decided that we would downsize big time and see if we could live really, really small with three kids. And we moved into this tiny 100-year-old batch that was essentially one bedroom. But it was close the door and stroll down to the beach close, you know. And it was that those years were really precious because you know, we could just, the kids would say, let's go to the beach. And we'd just say, yeah, okay, let's go. And you know, just grab your things and toddle on down to the stream. And there were a few families down there at the time who were in the same boat. And it was just a wonderful community. And the kids would, you know, catch tadpoles and make boats out of flax sticks and, you know, just do proper good outdoors things, you know, without the screens, like you were saying before. So important.
Wow, what a beautiful, beautiful picture. And isn't it interesting how it's almost like you had to move away from the city in order to make good connections? And it's like, you know, that the rat test, you know, the rat city. Have you ever heard that experiment?
Yes.
Rat
city, yes.
Where they put rats in all together and too close to each other. And, you know, we're not born to be isolated. We're definitely born to be in communities, but we're not born, I don't believe, to be shoved on top of each other. And the defense mechanism in cities that I've experienced most of my life is to deliberately not know who your neighbor is, because it's such an overwhelming feeling to have so many people so close. And yet when you have the opportunity and you take the risk of kind of maybe income over lifestyle, and you take that risk, it's not a privilege and it's not lucky. It's a lot of guts to do it, because you describe a situation where, you know, it was clear you didn't have much from what you say. You're not whining and bleating about it, but you're making it very clear that it was a choice and it was a brave choice. But isn't it interesting that we have to be away from an overly concentrated society where people are slammed into confined spaces, in order to be human again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that happened by, the choice thing was, obviously we made the choice first, but when we were looking, it was my eldest boy was coming up to school age, and I wasn't happy with where we were living and the school options that were around, and so we were looking to shift into a better zone for a better school. And I just accidentally hit the wrong button on a Trade Me search looking for rentals. And up came this house, this most incredible house. And it was out at Karikari Beach. And it was nowhere near where we were looking, because, you know, it's a half an hour drive back into civilization. It's a long way to go. Through windy roads, it's quite treacherous. You know, the power's always on and off. We knew what it's like to live in places like this. But with children, and another one was on the way, number three was on the way. And because we'd been married out at Karikari Waterfall, which is a really beautiful spot, a few years prior. And we thought, let's just go and have a look at this place, even though it's not where we were looking at all, completely different lifestyle. And we went there and we looked around and we were like, oh, this is it. We just have to. This is not on our plan at all, but let's just do it. And we got the place and we moved in, and that was in 2009, I think. So quite a long time ago now. And yeah, I'm just so pleased that I hit that wrong search button that day, and our future changed.
Yes, on one of our Psychobabble programs recently, Rene, who's one of my great heroes, he says nothing's really a coincidence, because he had a heart attack, and if he'd been in the area that he lives in, there's not a hospital for miles, but he just happened to be visiting his son in Christchurch, where there was a level 3 hospital. And he was, you know, literally his life was saved by coincidence. He just happened to be in that place. And they said, if you'd have been, you know, 5 minutes later, we wouldn't have been able to, you wouldn't have lived, you know, and it was that close for him. And he's back on the radio with us, chattering away like there's no stopping him. And he said, you know, the learning from that is there's no such thing as a coincidence. You pressing that button, I don't believe it was a coincidence.
No, I don't believe in coincidences either. I mean, you know, it's one of these things, isn't it? It's like Paul Brennan said recently in a little clip that went around on social media about how all of your experiences up to this point in your life have led you to what you're doing now. And I truly believe that. Like, I don't think, you know, that you even have a choice to a degree in what you, I don't feel like what we're doing now was a choice. It just was something that we had to do. And, you know, thankfully everything that we had, all three of us, Libby, Claire and I, everything that we had done in our lives individually had prepared us for what we were about to do together. And that's been
the burning question in my mind that I wanted to ask you, and it's fine if you don't, but how on earth did you three ever come together and meet up? Were you longtime friends? Tell me a little bit about that friendship with Claire and Libby, if you're still friends, that is.
Yes, we are still very much friends. We're like in each other's pockets. Well, Libby and I were involved in the same yarn industry in New Zealand. So, you know, those the terribly dastardly crocheters and knitters in the country who like children's food and looking after your children and things like that, that the Web of Chaos did that little clip about. And so we were both designers and we took workshops. And so we kind of came across each other at an event and got talking and realized that we had a lot in common in terms of our parenting sort of philosophy and that sort of thing. And so we'd known each other for a few years before COVID hit. And Claire and Libby worked in the same sort of area of law, and I think Claire worked with Libby's husband at a certain practice for a period of time, and so they had a separate connection that came together in the first beginnings of COVID in a Facebook group chat, just the three of us. Goodness no, I don't even know how it happened. It must have been Libby, and we were just fire through articles and research and ping ideas off each other in that space for months on end through the first part of the lockdowns and things of COVID. And then came that 2020 election and a desire to want to change what was happening with the trajectory of the country. That was a failure. And we weren't ready to give up after that. And so that was where VFF was born, out of that failure to have any political kind of influence. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
It's one of those, New Zealand's a small place, I suppose.
Yeah, it certainly is.
I'm sure there was some kind of divine hand above that, pulling the three of us together, though, because we had the sorts of skills between the three of us that could make a success of what we were doing going forward. And none of us could have done this on our own. It was only because of the skills and the expertise and the experience that each other has that they could bring to the mix.
And I think that in itself is such an important message or lesson for all of us, really, particularly as we move forward in these tricky times. I think they're tricky times anyway, that there is this kind of Kiwi spirit that is incredibly fiercely independent, creative, genius in many ways. I mean, Kiwis have this justifiable reputation for being innovative, for getting on with stuff, being immensely practical. And I think that has been eroded, I'm sure, but it's still there. And so there's this, on the one hand, there's this fierce, because I look at it like an outsider. I've only been here 3 years, you know, despite being born here, I'm a complete stranger. I'm a stranger in a strange land, you know, although I love it. But if on the one hand, you've got this culture of fierce independence, and down in the South Island where I am, it's really pronounced because people have just had to get on to survive. You know, there really wasn't a nanny state within a 4-hour drive anywhere. You know, if your axle broke, you had to find a way to fix it.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's on one hand. And on the other hand, you've got this basic psychological truth that when we're under stress and trauma, and this is where I think we can move in this conversation, perhaps move towards how we cope with stress, and in particular how you do. But one of the things that emerges over and over again is the need for support. That when we are faced with overwhelming support, that's when humans instinctively kind of reach out and lock arms to hold each other up, right? And yet we have this culture of fierce independence, you know, here in New Zealand. And so it's really important to hear, I think, of the role of support, you know, and connection with like-minded individuals for the future survival of this whole freedom movement. I don't even like calling it freedom. It feels like a movement for humanity, not a sort of special freedom we want, but actually we just want what is our God-given humanity. That's how we're made, you know? That's where I am with it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, Jerry. It shouldn't be something that you're having to fight for at this level, but here we are. It's ongoing. Yeah, I mean, the community has been the very best thing to come out of the last 4 years. And recently we met with the commissioners of the Phase 1 COVID inquiry, and in preparation for that, I needed to go back through all of our posts that thankfully are all coordinated there on our Telegram channel, because we'd lost our Facebook channel in, must have been 2021. And
I don't think you lost it by carelessness, did you? When you say you lost it, I think it wasn't like you forgot where it was.
It was removed from us by the hand of, I suspect, government and media and Facebook combined. But going back through all of those posts, boy, oh boy, was that a, because, you know, time goes on and you kind of, it was so crazy, everything that we were involved with. It's hard to remember it all because it was so intense. You know, these days where you were existing on 6 hours of sleep and working every single moment that you were awake. And so it's hard to remember exactly what was happening. But those posts, reading, there were thousands of them. I think there were nearly 3,000 posts, and I was going through every one to try and get my bearings as to exactly where the timeline was of different things and what we had done and what the government had done and said and all the contradictions and all of that sort of thing. And so it really lit my fire again, boy, oh boy, going into that meeting. But, you know, what came from that was this, I had written a letter, an open letter to Chris Hipkins at one point, where I had sort of thanked him for what he had done, had united so many of us about for and what was good, and to fight for the things that we should be fighting for, and how, you know, that nothing that they could do could touch that because it's so strong. Yeah. And so that, you know, I think we're overdue another sort of walk, another trip around New Zealand to go and meet all the different groups around the country. There's over 100 different VFF groups around the country. But the last time we did do that exercise, you know, the number of people that would just come up to you afterwards and give you a hug with tears, and the grown men who would not be able to speak, but when they finally kind of uttered out the words, which were, you saved my life, you know, through the tears, you knew that they were being genuine, you know, that community that was there, it literally stopped them from taking their lives at a time where they were on their knees, you know. And so I don't think that any of these people in these positions of authority who made the decision that they did have any idea of the level of trauma that they have caused, but also the connection that came as a result.
I'm really moved by what you describe, and have myself witnessed the life and death nature of human support and human community. In terms of health, we need this more than we need any drugs.
Yes.
This is what holds us up as humans. Yes, we can be amazing. And in fact, I keep quoting René de Monchy, the psychobabble psychiatrist and psychotherapist, but he said after his heart attack, recent heart attack, he found himself, you know, when he was walking around the streets, noticing how incredibly fragile people are. He kept noticing people that were walking with walking sticks or stopping because they were breathless, or walking around with the left side of their body clearly not functioning very well because they had a stroke. And he said, I just struck by how fragile humans are and how brave and heroic we all are at the same time. That it was like, you know, this sense of fragility standing strong that was so amazing. And I think a key part of this is, I mean, listen, I hereby award you, Claire and Libby, the Nobel Peace Prize for New Zealand. I just want you to know. And I think if medals ever get handed out, and I know you're too grounded and in your reality of everything you do, not to be embarrassed by this, but, you know, when the medals get handed out, you three should get the first three medals, I believe, for New Zealand. And if I vote for anyone for prime minister, it's going to be one of you three, you know. And that, I wouldn't like to do that because that would be like a poison chalice, wouldn't it?
But sentence. None of us want to do that job.
Coming back to you, I mean, there you are, that picture you paint of, you know, 3,000 posts, you're reading through them because you know you're going to visit these commissioners and you did that. And my goodness, I interviewed Linda Wharton not so long ago. I said the same question. How do you cope with hearing and being in touch with so much pain, so much suffering? How did you cope with that? What did you do? Did you, you know, take up gambling or alcohol? I don't know. How did you?
Well, I think it's probably twofold. If I think back, one of the people who's probably had the most impact in my life is a very special friend who kind of taught us over the last, sorry, dogs, who kind of taught us over the last 20, 30 years about communication and relationships and spirituality. And prior to meeting him and listening to his talks over the years, I was a real worrywart. I was quite highly strung. I was reactionary. I mean, I guess maybe that's just your youth as well. But what he helped me to see was how to effectively communicate with people and how to put things in perspective in your own mind as to how to deal with things that come up, challenges, disappointments, conflict, trauma, all of those sorts of things. And his famous quote that I will never forget is how to remain seated through the entire performance. So how to be able to stay stable when everything around you is crumbling or somebody's telling you that something terrible that they've done without reacting, and to just listen and respond appropriately and keep it together. And so I guess over the last 25 years, I've been practicing that. And then having three sons was another way to kind of perfect that, because, you know, with sons comes blood. And I was probably a bit of a helicopter mum with the first one when he was weeny. And then I realized with number two, who learned to climb the fridge before he could walk, like he was a daredevil, this kid. And he would be up the top of everything before you could, you know, turn around. And so I learned to just look the other way and just accept that what will be will be. Not being negligent, but just not trying to control everything and to deal with the consequences and take the lessons that come from those. So, you know, now I think recently one of my sons wiped out on one of our Nifty 50 scooters in the last couple of months and came back and kind of collapsed on my bed with his foot all mangled, and it was fairly gruesome. And, you know, I just sort of say, get me the first aid kit. And I just go, you know, without kind of losing the plot and crying or panicking about getting to hospital or anything, we just sit down. What can we do? What's the first thing we need to do? Take a deep breath. And, you know, it's just that sort of, I guess I've just learned that over the years. And that's what I mean when I say that your whole life has prepared you for this. And so when things are getting tough, you just reflect back. What can you do about it? Can you do anything about it? If you can't do anything about it, what's the point of worrying about it? That's going to bring you nothing but pain and waste time. Do what you can and, you know, make changes to what you do in the future if that's what's necessary. So, yeah, I mean, in a way, I guess on a physical level, there's other things that you do to kind of keep steady. And that would be, I go outside every night and I look up at the stars. I wear bare feet and spend time on the sand and on the grass. to try and just remember that you are really small. You're a tiny little ant on this earth and, you know, put things back into perspective. And I laugh a lot and I swear a lot. And those things help. You know, if I think about the rage that I get, and I deliberately do that. So I read through those posts, not only to know, to remind myself of what happened, but to also refill that rage cup. Because for me, I don't hold on to the rage and anger. I use it as the fuel that keeps me going. So all the injustices that I read about, like the other day I sent out an email and I got hundreds of responses back, people's experiences, and I read those. And you read them and it makes, you know, I swear and I carry on while I'm reading them. I can't believe that this sort of stuff happened. And it's so unjust that people's lives have been still impacted to this day by what happened. But I don't sit in that anger. I just, I let it be the fuel that drives me forward every day, that gets me up happy. Like, I'm not unhappy to do this work. It's my passion. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's a unique thing. Maybe it's not. But that is the way that it works in my little brain.
Well, there's nothing little about your brain, Alia. And I think what you've just shared is so valuable, because you are right out there on a daily basis. And your description of support from a, you know, and guidance from someone who sounds very wise and very understanding of what it means to be human and in relationship and going through trauma, that sounds like almost an amazing discipline. And I do think there are disciplines around managing ourselves. And I think the philosophy of being able to work out that which we can make a difference to and that which we can't. And being able to, I mean, it's a beautiful description, really, Alia. If I can just reflect a moment on what you've just said, in case I've got it wrong. So I'm kind of checking out with you, really. I think you're talking about how staying in your boots and keeping your bum on the seat through the performance, like through the theatre show, right the way to the end, and somehow remaining grounded in what you can and can't do, grounded in perspective, keep a perspective that acknowledges we're just, it feels big to us, but in the scale of things, I don't know, in 500 years, will anyone even remember what happened here in New Zealand? I don't, you know, it's so important to us what's going on, and yet maybe no one will even think about it. You know, life moves on, children grow, they have children, you'll come to that soon in your life. And if you're still around, you might see them have children. I hope to make it that far, but I don't know whether I will, but I hope to. And life kind of carries on. And so it's almost like you both connect with it and stay with it and, as it were, really connect with the performance. And at the same time, you go out to those stars and you just realize how tiny we are in the scale of things. Have I captured any of that philosophy?
Yeah, I think you have. I think that's true. It's right. And surround yourself with the people that really matter too. Discard the stuff. You know, when to stop that sort of online interaction with somebody that's doing you no service. You know, like, just choose carefully as to who you allow into your world.
Yeah. Well, and possibly that element of being wise around where you put your energy and time, that is one of the keys, right? That is so important. But the other element, of course, is getting human time with good people around you, that we all need that, and build that resilience. It's the oxygen mask theory, right? Grab the oxygen mask for yourself. And I think to all the listeners, and I'm sure there are going to be loads who just are going to be so interested in hearing from you in a way that I don't think you can even comprehend. But But the idea that, you know, yes, it would be great to change other people, but job number one, I am believing more and more, is this could be a marathon. You thought you signed up for a sprint, but you actually could be in for a marathon. So grab the oxygen mask, you know, get your nutrition, slow the pace down. I used to run sprint, and then I learned to run marathons myself. And my goodness, the tedium of going slow for me. I was a rushing fast guy and used to love that. But going slow, going steady, and it's a kind of tortoise and hare story.
Mm.
It's the tortoise that's going to win, right? We're the tortoises, and we got to keep going steady and grab those oxygen masks and look after each other and ourselves before we try and either change or rescue those people who have yet to face the horror that we've been seeing full on for the last 4 years.
Yeah, it's taken a little bit. I mean, we've known that all along, but to be honest, especially Claire and I have run ourselves into the ground over the last few years. Health-wise, you know, it's not been good. Our relationships with our families and things have definitely suffered by us being complete workaholics and prioritising everyone else above our own families, which is terrible. But more recently, we're starting to get a bit more balance back in that space. And we recognise that, you know, we've known for a long time that this is a patience game. And we have some pretty big goals and we know where we're going. But you really just got to have deep breaths and realise this is, you know, just take the little wins as they come and keep plodding forward, because the people that, you know, the entities that we've been up against, they've been doing the same thing for decades. And probably longer. And so we can't just race at everything full speed, because it's not going to have the desired result. And that might mean that you don't do all the things that people would like you to do. But in the long term, we have to keep our eye on the prize and what we're actually trying to do here. And while there's certain things that we would like to see along the way, sometimes you've just got to let some of that stuff go. For the bigger, you know, the bigger aim.
Well, Alia Bland, we've run out of time. I think we've run over time. thank you so much for sharing yourself and your life. And I want to say, you know, when I talked about medals, before I would give any of you guys medals, it would, of course, be your families that received the first ones, right?
Oh dear, I'm very lucky that my youngest loves cooking. So he cooks a lot for the family.
Well, and sometimes, you know, those pressures produce real gifts in terms of, if he didn't have to cook, he might never have bothered. So, you know, necessity is the mother of invention and creativity, and actually probably all human growth. So, yeah, good on you. But listen, thank you so much for sharing yourself and your life with me and the listeners, and sitting here in the psychotherapist chair. I feel like I could just go on and on and on with you. It's so interesting to hear how you function, but it's time to let you go back to your busy life. So, Alia Bland, thank you for sitting with me here in the psychotherapist chair.
Oh, thanks, Jerry. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for everything that you've done as well for New Zealand and the community and your community. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.